to talk about it in. This particular one fell on this particular Sunday, and I didn't realize what Sunday it was until just like a week or a week and a half ago. And then I was like, I don't know if I want to talk about this on this Sunday. But it was too late to change, so I'm doing it anyway. So for those of you that don't know the significance of this Sunday, my husband died 2 days ago this year. Two years ago. So this week has been an anniversary for me. And I think it doesn't matter, you know, and then all of it, when I look back, I'm like, oh yeah, it mattered. Yeah. So I've been a little bit edgy with people. I've been a little bit like not my normal self, we'll say. Okay? Maybe it is my normal self. Maybe it is, and just like the barriers are down. So, but moving on. One of the questions from the very beginning that has haunted me and that I will say continues to haunt me: how can you believe when what you believe does not match up with what your eyes see? Martha of the Mary and Martha of Bethany gives us an answer to this dilemma. Not a complete and total answer, but certainly a role model of how we can move forward with this believing business. We're going to take a look at Martha and her interaction with Jesus, but first I want to give you an idea of who Martha is. Last time I talked, we talked about the woman at the well, and I tried to give you a good idea of, first of all, who she wasn't, and then who she was, and how we could make sense of her conversation with Jesus. So I'm going to do the same thing here with Martha: who she isn't, and then who she is, so we can make sense of her conversation. So in our culture, and you guys hear me say that a lot, and you might be getting tired of hearing me say it, but in our culture, we have been led to a conclusion about Martha based on what we understand from her story. And get tired of hearing me say this, our understanding from our culture is different than how their culture would have understood. So we see pictures of Martha in classical paintings. And we have it's the Mary and Martha in Jesus story. And the picture is Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet, and Jesus is sitting there, and Martha's standing with some unidentifiable food substance in her arms, and she has a scowl on her face, and Jesus is going like this to Mary, and he's going like this to Martha. Okay? Very, very clearly a rejection of Martha's service and an acceptance of what Mary is doing. So this is an indication of how we in our culture look at this Mary and Martha story. Martha is presented to us as an aggressive, whining, unpleasant peasant girl, where Mary is presented to us as a meek, quiet, pious role model for all of us women, right? Okay, how many of you fit into that? Nope. Okay, so we move forward from that, and we don't want to be like Martha. But at the end of my talk today, I want to tell you, be like Martha. So part of our misunderstanding stems from this picture of Mary sitting at the feet of Jesus. So we read that Mary sat at Jesus' feet while Martha was burdened with much service. Okay, so what that means in that culture would be, first of all, the phrase sitting at Jesus' feet is an idiom. It's a figure of speech. Paul uses it when he talks about who his rabbi was. And all of the disciples, when Jesus was on earth, they sat at Jesus' feet. So that just means that Jesus was their rabbi. So by saying Mary sat at Jesus' feet, what Luke is telling us, the story's in Luke, what Luke is telling us is that Mary was a disciple. But it says, too, Mary was also a disciple, and it says that in reference to Martha. So we can assume that Mary and Martha sat at Jesus' feet. Mary and Martha were both disciples. And Martha coming into the room and speaking to Jesus about Mary as if Mary wasn't there wouldn't happen. It simply would not happen. That would be the height of rudeness to both Mary and to their guest of honor, Jesus. So Martha coming in and speaking like that would mean Mary wasn't there. Mary was not physically sitting at Jesus' feet in the front room while Martha was in the kitchen doing the work. Mary was gone. Probably Jesus knew where Mary was because Martha said to him, "Go tell her that I am serving here alone." Okay, so more than likely, this is conjecture, and I'm going to talk about conjecture in a minute. More than likely, Mary was in Jerusalem, which is about 5 kilometers away from Bethany. All right, so we're going to assume that because, based on the honor-shame culture idea, that Mary was not in the room at the time. And so when Martha comes to Jesus and says, "Tell her that I'm serving alone," she probably means what she says. Okay, so she's alone and she has a service that she's performing. We take Martha and put her in the kitchen because that's where women belong, right? Okay, so there's Martha in the kitchen and she's trying to cook this big meal for Jesus and nobody's helping her. Okay, but here's the thing about the family of Mary and Martha. We have speculated that Mary and Martha are peasant girls who live in this small village who Jesus comes to visit, and all of what we see has come through that lens. But there are some clues in the Bible and some clues in extra-biblical sources that show us that this is not the case with this family. So here's a couple of things that we can find in the Bible that shows us who this family actually might be. Okay, so first of all, Martha's name. Martha is not a Hebrew name. It's not an Aramaic name. It's not a name at all until we get to later on in the, you know, down the centuries. Okay, so Martha, the name, the word Martha is Aramaic, and it means, it's the feminine of master. Okay, so we would say the feminine of master is mistress, but in our culture, mistress has a bad connotation, so that's not a good way for us to go. So we just need to stick with master. Okay, Martha was a title. People called her master. She was master of something. Right? This puts her on in pretty high standing in her community. We know that she had a house. She was master of her house. Extra-biblical sources have shown us that there was a family, a very rich and very a family in very high standing who owned the land that this town of Bethany was built on. And at one point, at the beginning of this passage in John, we learn that Bethany was the town of Mary and Martha. It doesn't say the town Mary and Martha lived in, but that verb, I mean the preposition of carries the connotation of to be owned by. So speculation, were Mary and Martha from a family that owned the town of Bethany? It's very possible, because we have the extra-biblical sources that point to that, as well as the biblical sources that, if you look at it in the original language, it seems like maybe they were. Okay, so important people in the city, and that's possibly why, because they possibly were actually the masters in that city. Now, we have another clue in the Bible of who they were. Farther on in the Gospel of John, Mary and Martha come up again. And in that story, they're giving a feast, and Martha served the feast. And we have this idea from our culture that Martha was being a servant. She was standing in the background, making sure everybody's glass was full of water, and that they had butter for their bread, and that sort of thing. Once again, we're putting Martha in the kitchen. Okay? But what this actually means, do you remember last week when Bob spoke? Who remembers? Last week when Bob spoke, he gave us a brief picture of what a feast would look like when he said that the host of the feast would sit at the table and on either side would be the guests of honor, and then it would, you know, as the table moved farther away, the less important people sat farther away. Okay, so when we see that Martha served this meal, this is what it means in that culture. Martha sat at that place in the middle of the table. Martha was the host. And Jesus sat on one side of her. Her raised brother Lazarus sat on the other side of her. Okay, Martha served. This is how this feast would work. The servants would bring the food in and they would place it in front of the host, the master of the house. The master would then get up and serve the guests. and then go back and begin to eat him or herself. So when we see that Martha served, what we're being told is that Martha was the master of the feast in this house. Okay, so once again, that picture is showing us Martha as being a very important person in her family and in her town as well. Okay, something else we know. We know this family was wealthy. And we know this because at this feast where Martha served, Mary had a bottle of spikenard. Now, how many of you guys are, you don't have to raise your hands, it might be embarrassing. How many of you guys are into essential oils? Okay. Okay, so you know that some of them are like cheap, like peppermint, you know. You know, some of them are really super expensive, a little bottle of whatever, you know, $100, right? Okay, so this spikenard was very, very expensive. This is not something that a peasant girl would save up her pennies and buy just to have. In fact, it wasn't even allowed. Normal people, ordinary people, I should say, could not have spikenard because it was used for two very special purposes. One of those purposes was it was kept in the temple and it was used as the base for the mixture of oils to anoint the king. So the only use for that in that setting would be the high priestly family would have spikenard. The other setting would be in a hospice setting because spikenard was used to cure skin conditions. So a healer would also have spikenard. Nobody else would have it. This wasn't a thing where just, you know, anybody could get it who wanted it. The spikenard that Mary used, it's said in the Bible, cost as much as a whole year's wages. Okay, so think how long it will take you to save up a whole year's wages. Okay, if you stopped having coffee, it's going to take a while, right? So, and it simply wasn't available. So we know from the fact that Mary had this spikenard and used it that the family was wealthy enough to actually own it. Now, healers in those days were women. So if Mary and Martha were healers, which there's some evidence for that too, that's why they would have had this. But also, if you remember, Mary anointed Jesus with it just before he did his ride into Jerusalem when he came in as their king. So being anointed with this oil would make Jesus smell like a king for at least a week. Okay, so think about that when you think about Jesus riding in. It's not just the donkey, it's the aroma that surrounds him as he goes in. Okay, so we're told that Martha is doing much service. Taking her out of the kitchen, we're going to think, what kind of service could Martha be doing? So here is where archaeology helps us out with some clues. The town of Bethany has been known to be a healing center since ancient times. They knew that since Lazarus lived there about 400 years, they had dug down about 400 years after Lazarus had lived there, and there was healing centers all over. It had definitely become a hospice community. But digging deeper in recent years and looking at some of the literature that's come out of that era, they have discovered that it was a healing center even before we have evidence of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. So Bethany is the exact distance from the gates of Jerusalem that the Torah says there has to be a community for people who are sick and who are removed from the community. So they're in isolation, they're in quarantine. Okay, so the Essenes had a leper's community there, and they found evidence of this to be even before Mary and Martha and Lazarus' time. So it seems as if Bethany has been a healing community, a hospice community from way back. So the idea that Mary and Martha are living in this community and that Martha has service in this community, that they possibly own the land. And you see, I'm getting into some speculation here. I don't want you to think that I'm stating this stuff as fact. But here's the thing with the facts and the speculation. We have speculated that these girls are peasant girls based on absolutely nothing except for our own prejudices from our own culture. Okay, so, but we have evidence to show that this is possibly the trajectory that this story of Mary and Martha, the trajectory that it's taking. Okay, I'm not saying this is it. I'm not saying set in stone. I'm not saying, you know, this is my theory and I love it, so I'm going to present it to you as pure fact. Okay, but there's way more evidence that Mary and Martha are from a wealthy family and are important people. Why? It might, you know, we could go different directions as to why they're so important. But the idea to bring forward is that Mary and Martha and Lazarus are very important people. Okay, we're going to move to the story now. So we see the importance in this story when we're told that the Jews came from Jerusalem to help them mourn. I've talked about this word Jew before. And in John, the word is Judaioi, and it's used to mean not just the Jews who live in Israel, but the word Judaioi is Judean. It means the Jews who live in Judea, but John uses it to mean the rulers of the Jews, because the Judeans were the rulers. Not all Judeans were rulers, but they were in that line. They were in that clan. So when John says that the Judaioi came to help them mourn, he's saying the important people from the temple came to help them mourn. Okay, they would not do this for a peasant family. Okay, this is a family who has connections in Jerusalem, who is powerful. So these are the clues that we get in the Bible for who these people are. Okay, now here's one thing more. And this, once again, I want to say this is conjecture or speculation based on some clues that we have. If these people were very powerful people in the Jerusalem power center and in the social climate, then they were probably Sadducees. Okay, do you hear that? Probably. All right. If they were Sadducees, Sadducees do not believe in the resurrection of the dead. So this gives, when Martha says, "I believe," this gives her belief a whole different importance to us. Okay, so once she did not believe, now she believes. We're going to talk about that a little bit more when we get to it in the text. Okay, so I want you to draw a broad picture of Martha, hopefully leaving out most of the speculation. Okay, Martha was a prominent member of a wealthy and important family who had embraced Jesus' radical teaching and is living it out in a ministry, possibly among the sick in Bethany. Okay, so take that idea of Martha, and let's let it change what your picture is, and let it change how we're going to look at this story. Okay, so we didn't read the beginning. We didn't read from John 1 because that would have taken, John 11, 1, that would have taken too long of a time. And I'm just going to recap the story. You have it printed out in your printout so you can go back and read it word for word if you want to. So Mary and Martha are taking care of their sick brother Lazarus. Jesus is over somewhere else. Because of the political climate at the time, he has had to leave Jerusalem, and he's over across the Jordan, so he's a couple of days' journey away from Jerusalem. And remember, Jerusalem and Bethany are right next to each other. Okay, so a messenger comes to Jesus, and the messenger says, "The one you love is sick." Okay, they know who it is. They know what the messenger is talking about. And there's an interesting thing about why maybe Lazarus is not mentioned. And it kind of carries over to why we only have the story in the Gospel of John. Have you ever wondered why such an important story is only told to us once? Well, some scholars believe that because of the political climate at the time, Jesus' disciples were in danger. That's known. Jesus' disciples were in danger. Jesus had gone across the Jordan, but the ones who remained were also in danger. So if Mary and Martha and Lazarus, we know that they're Jesus' disciples, but they have not fled. They have stayed where they were, but their lives are in danger. And so there's a lot of like code going on. We see that in some of the other stories that we kind of take for granted too, where the disciples are talking to each other in code. So mentioning Lazarus's name, and especially after he was raised from the dead, could put his life in danger. And we know his life was in danger because later on in the Gospel of John, it says the Jewish leaders decided to kill Lazarus too, because he's the living proof of what Jesus did. Okay, so scholars think that that is possibly why this story has been suppressed until John wrote it down, because he wrote it down so much later. Possibly Lazarus is now dead and is no longer in danger. Okay, so what I'm trying to get across to you is that this is a real story that happened in a real time, in a real place, in a real political climate. Things are really happening at this time. Okay, so Jesus gets the message that Lazarus is sick, but then he doesn't do anything for 2 days. And then all of a sudden he says, okay, guys, disciples, gather around. We're going back to Judea. And his disciples are like, wait, we can't do that. They just tried to stone you. They're going to kill you if you set foot inside their territory. And then Jesus says, look at your paper that was handed out to you. If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees by the light of the world. But if he walks in the night, he stumbles because there's no light in him. Some translations say in the world. Now, this is something that Jesus has talked about a lot in the Gospel of John. But we're not going to go into that because you guys want to get home for lunch, right? Okay, but I put it in here because I wanted you to see the parallels, my signature coloring of the lines. You can take a look at the parallels on your own time, right? Okay, so the disciples then say, okay, if Jesus is going to go, let's go with him and let's die with him. Okay, this gives you an idea of what the political climate is like. They truly expected that they would die with Jesus when they went to Judea. I lost my place. Okay, so Jesus comes to the town, but notice he doesn't enter the town. It's not safe for him to enter the town. Martha comes out to meet him. We're going to take a look at this conversation, moving our idea of Martha now forward into this conversation. Martha says to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. She fully acknowledges Jesus' power to heal because she's seen it a lot. Even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. This is interesting because she is attributing the power to God, and God is using Jesus as his conduit for that power. But we don't have that last step where she is acknowledging Jesus as God yet. Okay, so she knows that Jesus can heal, and she knows that God listens and uses Jesus to perform his powerful deeds. Jesus says to her, your brother will rise from the dead. And she says, I know he will rise in the resurrection on the last day. Okay, now if she did not believe in the resurrection, and now she does, this is a key statement of belief for her. And in fact, some of the translations of our Bible translate Martha saying, I have come to believe. So that gives credence to the idea that she did not believe and now she does believe. So whatever Jesus has been teaching her, she has embraced about the resurrection on the last day. And then Jesus says to her, I am the resurrection and the life. Okay, I want you to pay attention to the color coding here. Okay, there's two aspects of what Jesus says. Jesus is the resurrection. He who believes in me, though he dies, shall live again. That's Jesus as the resurrection. Jesus is the resurrector, the one who can resurrect. Okay, and the life. Jesus says, I am the life. I am the life giver. Whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Okay, now you got to think a minute. What Martha has just been through. She has seen her brother die. She has seen him draw his last breath. She has watched his body grow cold. She has washed it. She has bathed it. She has dressed it and she has wrapped it. And she has carried it and she has put it in the tomb. And Jesus says to her, whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? No, Martha. It's not God that's giving me the power. It's me, he says to her. Martha, look at me. I am the resurrection. I am the life. Do you believe this, Martha? How can Martha believe this? What her eyes saw, what she saw. And Jesus is saying, no, look at me. Look at me. I am the resurrection. I am the life. And Martha says, yes, Lord, I have come to believe that you are the Christ. Okay, so what does that mean? You are the Christ. Okay, Peter has previously said, Lord, we believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God. Okay, so Christ is the Greek word for the Hebrew word Messiah, which is the word that means anointed one. So Martha is saying, I have come to believe that you are the anointed one. Okay, Jesus hasn't been anointed yet. He doesn't get anointed for another week when Mary does it. And then she says, the Son of God. Okay, so I've talked about the Son of God before and how it doesn't always necessarily mean the divinity. But in this particular case, because we go back to John's teaching in John 3:16, where he records that Jesus said, where Jesus said, God sent his only begotten Son into the world. And that's a different phrase than the Son of God. When John is talking about, when John says the Son of God, he's harking back to that, what Jesus said, the only begotten Son, the DNA of God. Okay, so this is not the Son of God as David and the other kings were called, sons of God, lowercase s, but this is Son of God, the only begotten Son of God, the DNA of God, Martha says. I believe that you have the DNA of God in you, which is different than God hears and answers your prayers. Okay, he who comes into the world, Martha adds this to what Peter has said that he believes. Martha says, you're the one who was promised to come into the world. The promises from the prophets. In Isaiah, it says, by his wounds we are healed. This is what Martha is believing when she says, the one who's promised to come into the world. Ezekiel, I myself will come and take care of my sheep. Martha's confession of faith here. Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the anointed one. You're the Son of God in the DNA. And you're the one who the prophets promised would come into the world. So this is what Martha believes. Jesus is saying, don't look at what you see with your eyes. But look at this. Look at this. Look at this. So when Martha says, I believe, she is acknowledging Jesus as the life giver. From old, back in the garden, back before the garden, back during creation, God was the life giver. The Holy Spirit breathed into Adam and Eve, into Adam and brought him life. This confession of Martha's takes in from back then all the way up to what is happening to her now. I believe that you are the life giver. So now we're going to fast forward. We're going to put Jesus now at the tomb. He's already talked to Mary. The Jewish leaders who do not like him are there watching at the tomb, and there's Jesus. And it says that Jesus was deeply moved. Okay, that the word for deeply moved means actually to roar with anger. It's a word that means angry. Jesus is standing in front of the tomb and he is angry. And I've said this before, it's okay to be angry at death, but be angry at the right thing. Okay? Be angry at Satan and be angry at death. And here's Jesus being angry at Satan and angry at death. And he is roaring because he is so angry at it. It means to make an angry noise. He's mad at the situation caused by Satan at the fall of humanity way back in the garden. It says Jesus was troubled. It says Jesus wept. All those emotions, the human emotions that culminate again in anger, because it says when he opened the tomb, he roared again in anger. And this time, Jesus is throwing down the gauntlet to death. He's going, okay, the battle's going to start. This is where it starts. And he's beginning that war right here. We've seen him already bringing some people alive from the dead. A couple of Bible stories. One, we have the unimportant daughter of a minor religious official. We don't even know her name. We have an unnamed son of an unimportant widow. Both of those could be, the people looking on could be, well, you know, that girl, she wasn't really dead. That little girl, she wasn't really dead. You know, the people had a belief that the person's spirit hovered about the body for 3 days after they died. And it's possible in their minds that the spirit could have re-entered and reanimated the body. This was a, I mean, I hesitate to use the word superstition, you know, but this was a belief that they had, right? Okay, Lazarus, he's dead 4 days. Lazarus is not mostly dead. Lazarus is all the way dead. Okay, some of you know what I'm talking about. So we have those two people who we don't have names for and who maybe were not really super important, but here's Lazarus. And Lazarus is an important son of an important family, and all the Jewish leaders are there to watch what's going to happen next. So Jesus says, move the stone. And this is where Martha says, oh, but wait, there's likely to be a pretty bad smell here. And we have looked at Martha and we've said, oh, well, she doesn't really believe after all, right? But no, what Martha is doing here is she's protecting her guests. She has all these important religious officials. And if they are in the way of whatever odor is going to come wafting out of this open sepulcher, they are going to become ritually unclean. And it's going to be a big pain for not only them, but for the entire city of Jerusalem, because then they will not be available to do the daily sacrifices, because you have to be ritually pure to do the sacrifices. So Martha, making this comment, is saying, what do you want to do about this problem, to Jesus, right? And Jesus' response is, just believe, just believe. It is kind of important for us to understand about this just believe business that he's talking to Martha about. So he says to her, didn't I tell you, I gotta find it. Did I not say to you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God? Okay, now, at the very beginning, when Jesus was still across the Jordan, he says to his disciples, this sickness of Lazarus will not end in death. It will end to show the glory of God. So Jesus already knew that he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead. He wasn't waiting for Martha to show enough faith. He wasn't waiting to see if Martha would believe. This did not depend on whether Martha believed or not. If you read what Jesus says to her, it does not say, didn't I say that if you believe, I will raise Lazarus? Because he didn't say that. He says, you'll see the glory. So it's not the action that Martha's belief is instigating here. It is her ability to see the glory behind the action. And she will be able to see that glory in Jesus' action because she believes in Jesus. So that's something that I struggled with a long time. I mean, maybe I still struggle with it. If I just believed a little bit harder, would things have been different? You know? It's a question. I don't know if everybody has that question or not, you know, but I did. If I just believed harder, would things have turned out better? And here we see that it's not our belief, our ability to just believe as hard as we can, but that Jesus has decided he's going to act, and it's what we see in what Jesus actions. If we believe Jesus, what we see in his actions would be the glory of God. So then Jesus prays. The reason that he prays out loud, because he has told Martha, and essentially he says, I am the one that's going to do this. Okay, but he prays to God and he says, I know you hear me. The reason Jesus is doing this out loud is because in the past he has been accused of being in cahoots with the devil. He's been accused of sorcery. He's been accused of hypnotizing people so that they only see what they want to see. So Jesus is going to make this into a thing where everybody knows exactly what's happening. He prays to the God of Israel. He makes, there's no question about who he's praying to, the God of Israel. He has other people roll the stone away so that they can't accuse him of doing something like special with the stone. And then he cries in a loud voice when he calls to Lazarus. He cries loudly. He says, Lazarus, come forth, so that there's no muttering or whispering, because this was what the sorcerers would do. They would go in a corner and they would mutter and whisper, and then they would say, yes, my prayers have come true. Jesus does it out loud. Jesus does it so everybody can see what's happening. So this is the first major battle in Jesus' war against death. The life giver, Jesus the life giver, has given life to Lazarus. So this first battle that he's waging, Lazarus has been dead 4 days. From our viewpoint, from Martha's viewpoint, death wins. What we see, death wins. But Jesus comes. He steps up and he says, not today. Death does not win today. Hosea 13:14, I will redeem them from the power of the grave. I will deliver them from death. O death, I will be thy death. O grave, I will be thy destruction. Jesus wins the first battle with death. The second battle is about to start. Because of giving Lazarus life, Jesus has just signed his own death warrant. This is when they start in earnest, when the high priest says it's better that one man should die for all. Interesting, coming from the high priest's mouth. So the second battle is about to begin. The Jewish leaders have solidified their plans. A couple weeks later, Jesus is on the cross. Jesus is dead. Jesus is in his tomb. Death wins. What we see, death wins. Okay, but wait for it. Isaiah 25:7-8, on this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all people, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. So Jesus, as the life giver, has once again and finally defeated death. But there's a third battle, and that third battle is we die. The people that we love die. It still happens. Because the contract that we signed with the devil in the Garden of Eden, right? Oh, by the way, small print at the bottom of the contract, you actually do die. So our viewpoint, once again, we see death wins. Martha saw Lazarus dead. She saw Jesus as the resurrector, as the life giver in her faith. It was a long 4 days. Think about those 4 days when Lazarus was dead. It's been a long 2 years. It's been a long 20 years for some of you. It's been a long 2,000 years, right? Okay, we see death wins. But Lazarus' resurrection has shown us that death does not win, that Jesus actually is the winner here. Our eyes see. We have lots of questions. I have 1,000 questions. I don't have very many answers to the 1,000 questions that I have. But Martha models for us this amazing faith, looking forward to Jesus wins, death doesn't win, when Jesus says, he who believes in me, even though he dies, yet shall he live. Okay, let's pray. Dear Father, I don't know how you expect us to believe if we can't see it, if we can't feel it, if we can't touch and taste it. But please let us remember to look to Martha and her belief. And let us just remember that you're the one that has conquered death and that you're the one that wins. In your name, amen.